I think everybody will agree. We've had an absolutely wonderful first session. It's been fantastic. So this whole colloquium, when we conceived of this, the idea was to inspire people, a younger generation of scientists, and particular women scientists, to undertake the challenges of medical research. Now, those senior ones amongst us, we have some experience, but we can't really tell you how to do it. There are significant challenges. All we can really do is to inspire people with the kind of passion and to, you know, really to demonstrate just what fun it is being out there, being a woman scientist. And then you will solve those challenges. It's going to be hard, but somehow or other you will do it. So the next part of our program, we're going to continue to try to inspire you, but this time we've got this absolutely fabulous group of younger women scientists together. They're each doing absolutely brilliant things, and they are really inspired by science. They were chosen from a whole group of people because they show some passion for science. And so we're really looking forward to hear their presentations. They're going to do this in a kind of 3-minute bite. So they've got 3 minutes to sell you on why their science is absolutely brilliant and why they really enjoy doing it. I'm going to keep strictly to time. So we'll get started, and it's going to be a lot of fun. Okay, so our first speaker is Anna Price. Anna is a postdoctoral research fellow at Murdoch Children's Research Institute, and she's developing early interventions that can be delivered through primary care to improve children's mental health, especially for children living in social disadvantage. So Anna.
I don't have a slide. I don't have one.
Oh, you don't have any slides, right?
It's easy.
You don't have to worry about
that. It's easy. Okay. Generation Y's, like me, seem to be letting the other generations down. We have more access to wealth and resources than ever before, but it's not enough. We, apparently, are unable to commit. We expect far too much too soon, and we have very short attention spans. Now, these stereotypes may be a case of the earlier generations viewing their own upbringing through rose-coloured glasses, but if they're true, surely Gen Y is no match for research, which is often a lifelong pursuit, very slow moving, and requires a great deal of attention to detail. But here's how I think being a Gen Y and having a research career are compatible. We may be unable to commit, but research itself plays hard to get. It's hard to get funding, it's hard to run your study the way you planned, it's hard to publish your findings, and it's hard to use your findings to make a difference in the community. Success in any of these areas is unpredictable. But as anyone who's studied Skinner boxes in Psychology 101 knows, it's the least predictable intermittent reinforcement that keeps those rats pressing a lever. So research, which involves very unpredictable and rare reward, is the perfect job to keep the most non-committal animal, and I'm referring to Gen Y here, interested in their work. Research is slow. The time from thinking of a good research question to getting your findings, especially when you're studying human behaviour, can take years. But the unpredictable nature of research means that researchers tend to say yes to every opportunity. So those long, slow periods are frequently interspersed with periods of panic while researchers are desperately trying to meet report and grant writing deadlines, finish analyses, and publish and present their results. The good news is Gen Ys are excellent at multitasking and working under pressure. Now, while we can multitask, attention to detail is a challenge. How can a Gen Y even finish a PhD, for example, when it means spending 3 years on one very specific research question? Well, that research question is made up of a million finite, varied tasks, all which require their own, which all come with their own deadline and provide their own reward when achieved. If you don't believe in generational stereotypes, then really what I think makes a good researcher is eternal optimism and persistence. But if you like a generalisation, you only have to look at the name to know that Generation Y asks the questions and know that we're born ready for a life of research. Thanks.
Thank Thank you very much, Anna. I think the whole of Generation Y must be women if they're good at multitasking. Okay, so our next speaker is Rosemary Boland. Rosemary is a neonatal nurse with special interest in neonatal retrieval. She's undertaking a PhD in the Department of Obstetrics and Gynaecology here at Melbourne and is examining risk factors for very premature babies.
Thank you. My name is Rose Boland. I'm a midwife, a neonatal nurse, and a PhD candidate. And I'm all those things because I have a passion for very premature and sick babies. From the moment, and I remember it so well, that I helped the mother bring this baby into the world more than 23 years ago, that passion has really shaped my career. I've worked in neonatal intensive care units in Australia and New Zealand. I've worked in ambulances and aircraft retrieving sick babies from all over the state of Victoria. And I've worked as a nurse educator, educating thousands of GPs, paramedics and neonatal nurses in the care of preterm babies at birth. But over the course of many years, I became increasingly concerned about a problem that I saw that didn't seem to have a solution. Because despite all the advances in neonatal intensive care, there's one group of babies in Australia who continue to have significantly increased risk of morbidity and mortality, and I really wanted to know why. And so becoming a PhD candidate at the University of Melbourne has given me that opportunity not only to answer the why, but actually to do something about it. I always think that expectant parents have great hopes and great expectations. They expect that their baby will be born on time or close to their due date. They expect and they hope that their pregnancy will be without complications. And they expect, most importantly, that their baby will be born healthy. Sadly, the reality for many parents in Australia, in fact, more than 24,000 parents in Australia this year, will be not that reality, because their baby will be born prematurely. And we know that one in 12 couples will give birth to a very premature baby in Australia this year. We know that we can improve a preterm baby's chance of survival by one simple measure, and that is having the mother give birth in a tertiary perinatal centre. Here in Victoria, we have very well developed systems in place to ensure that high-risk women are transferred to a perinatal centre for the birth of their baby, and around 85% of the time we get that right. But there's still one in eight extremely premature babies who aren't born in a perinatal centre. And we know that if that happens before 28 weeks gestation, that the chance of that baby being stillborn or dying within the first few days or weeks of life is double that of babies who are born in a perinatal centre. But why? The media would have us believe that it's the hospital that's to blame, but I don't think it's that simple. I think that probably these mothers have other risk factors that make their babies more vulnerable, and that maybe some of these risk factors are preventable or treatable. So the aim of my research is to try and identify those risks. And it's something I'm incredibly passionate about because at the end of the day, it really could save a baby's life. Just like expectant parents, I too have great expectations. I really expect that I will discover the risk factors that contribute to these increased mortality rates in these babies. I expect to develop strategies to decrease the incidence of preterm birth in non-perinatal centres. But my greatest expectation of all is that as a result of my research, that more very premature babies will survive to go home. And it's very easy to be passionate about that. Thank you.
Thanks very much to Rose. Okay, so our next speaker is Caroline Yi. Caroline's a GP who studied traditional Chinese medicine and obtained a graduate qualification in medical acupuncture. She's now undertaking a PhD in the Department of General Practice and she's running a clinical trial on acupuncture for menopausal hot flushes. Caroline.
My name's Caroline Yi, and to explain my research passion of acupuncture, I have to put my background into context. Like many diligent and high-achieving students from Asian backgrounds, I chose a career in medicine. After three grueling years of hospital residency, I chose to study traditional Chinese medicine at RMIT University. This was driven both by my growing need to find myself and my culture as it was through my new studies, and a sense of disillusion with conventional medicine and its array of adverse effects. I obtained my fellowship of general practice with the intent of integrating acupuncture into my regular clinical practice. As a clinician, I saw acupuncture as a treatment with several advantages. It's safe. It's never been linked to cancer, heart disease, dementia, or renal failure. Side effects are uncommon and usually minor. It's non-pharmaceutical, and Chinese medicine emphasises the importance of lifestyle factors as a cause of disease, which is very relevant in these times. And somehow it made sense to me. It's beautiful to practice, almost being like delicate surgery. It's also very popular. However, during my studies, I was taught anecdotes rather than evidence, 2,000 years of rich anecdotes. As a Western-trained doctor, I needed more. I wanted to see the rigorous methods of scientific evaluation applied to these techniques. I needed to see beyond the Oriental mystique, fascinating as it were. I needed randomised controlled trials, systematic reviews, and meta-analyses. I see my role as helping to build a bridge between the two paradigms. A bridge is defined as a structure built to span physical obstacles such as a body of water, a valley or road, for the purpose of providing passage over the obstacle. The obstacles I face as an acupuncture researcher include the challenge of controlling for non-specific effects, which include the placebo effect, and translating Chinese medicine principles across to Western medical diagnoses. With my training in both the East and the West, I believe I'm uniquely placed to invite a two-way dialogue into research into acupuncture. Currently, I'm coordinating an NHNMRC-funded trial on acupuncture for postmenopausal hot flushes, which will recruit over 270 women. We have included Chinese medical diagnosis in our eligibility criteria and are attempting to standardise the treatment given so that a particular dose of acupuncture is provided. We are confident that our protocol will satisfy practitioners and experts from both Chinese and Western medicine. Beyond this study, there are so many other health conditions to evaluate. Common conditions such as polycystic ovarian syndrome, for which current treatment is suboptimal and involves side effects. I could and will spend a lifetime on this. There's so much that needs to be done. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Caroline. That was excellent. Okay, so our next speaker is Nicole LaGruta. Nicole holds a Sylvia and Charles Viertel Senior Medical Research Fellowship and heads her own research laboratory in the Department of Microbiology and Immunology. Her work seeks to understand the factors that determine T-cell responses to viral infections.
Thank you. My research really investigates the determinants of effective antiviral T-cell responses. So in our body, we have millions of T-cells specific for a whole range of pathogens that one might encounter over the course of a lifetime. And when we encounter a pathogen, for example, influenza virus, T-cells specific for that virus will expand and help to fight infection. So my research really is focused around a highly sensitive technique that enables us to actually identify influenza-specific T cells prior to the infection or prior to any immunisation or expansion of these cells. And so this is a relatively recently developed technique, and what it does really is it provides information on the potential of the immune system, and it really gives us information about what things we might be able to do to augment the response by, for instance, selecting out particularly potent T cells or augmenting the magnitude of the response. So that's my research in a nutshell, and I was also asked to talk about my passion for research, and I would have to say without a doubt that my passion is for fundamental research. I love the discovery, I love the knowledge generation, and I love the idea that research done now could have implications decades in the future in an area of human health that we perhaps haven't even considered yet. So I've always worked in fundamental research, in immunological fundamental research, albeit in different specific areas. I did my PhD at Monash University, and then I moved to Memphis, Tennessee for a postdoctoral position, and came back to help Professor Peter Doherty establish his lab here at the University of Melbourne. I really, along with Catherine Kajeska, who will be talking next, and Stephen Turner, the three of us really helped Peter establish his lab, and it's really with that support and working as part of that team that I've been able to establish my independent research career. So I guess I'm currently doing it, something that I never thought I'd be able to do. And in the future, I guess what I want to do is to continue to be able to do basic research, and especially in immunology, which is especially strong in Australia, because I constantly feel challenged and I usually feel outclassed, actually. And that's really, it gives me the advantage of feeling that any of my successes are particularly rewarding. Thank you.
Thank you, Nicole. So our next speaker, as you've heard, is Catherine Kajeska. Now, Catherine is also from the Department of Microbiology and Immunology. She's an NHMRC Level 2 research fellow. She's interested in T-cell immunity to the flu virus and immunity in the elderly. She was awarded a Scopus Young Researcher of the Year for the Medical Sciences Award.
Thank you, Leanne. So my major interest is in understanding immunity to viral infections, mainly in the context of a disease. During my PhD, I looked into how HIV-positive patients develop specific opportunistic infections as their disease progressed, ultimately the cause of their death. And I did my PhD at the Burnet Institute when it was still located in Fairfield as a part of an infectious diseases hospital. And it was in days prior to the development of highly active antiretroviral therapy. So on a daily basis, we had terminally ill HIV-infected patients walking in the gardens, in the hospital gardens. And there was this great sense of feeling that research needed to be done to understand this fatal disease. And the day that really shaped who I am as a researcher was when my PhD supervisor and a great mentor, Susan Crowe, came to the lab and said that based on my in vitro results, which showed that GM-CSF can enhance killing of Mycobacterium avium, a patient with severe drug-resistant Mycobacterium avium infection would like to undergo GM-CSF therapy. And the patient did, and he got much better within 2 days after GM-CSF treatment. His conditions improved and Mycobacterium avium dropped. So it really showed me that and translation from what we do in the lab into the clinic can be literally one day away. As after I did my PhD, I did my postdoc here at the University of Melbourne. I enjoyed it enormously, worked with a great mentor, Professor Peter Doherty, and alongside with two other brilliant scientists like Nicole LaGruta and Steve Turner. During my postdoc, I went to a dark side and made work with mice, but I think it really allowed me to, it really taught me how to ask core basic research questions. So now, having my own group, I try to combine this core basic research questions with my human immunology training, which I'm really passionate about, to understand the immunity to pandemic and seasonal influenza viruses circulating in human population. And as all of you know, influenza can be quite serious. I've always loved being at the bench, doing bench research. Unfortunately, I don't get a chance to do much lab work these days, so I really get inspired by the enthusiasm of young and talented people working with me, and that you can see here, currently Nikki, Emma, Sergio, and Zongfang, and on the right it's Sophie, who recently finished her PhD and started her postdoc, so she's left the lab. But that actually makes me feel really privileged that in what we do in the lab, we get to assist training of the next generation of young scientists. Thank you.
So thanks to Catherine. And now, last but not least, we have Saskia Polling. Saskia holds an international research scholarship to pursue her PhD in the Department of Biochemistry and Molecular Biology. Her project involves deciphering how cells deal with misfolded and aggregated proteins to protect themselves from diseases such as Huntington's.
Hi everyone. So I'm Saskia and I came from the Netherlands, and there I did my bachelor's and master's degree, and it was focused more on energy supply and immune cells. But since then I've shifted towards Melbourne, which was an awesome opportunity. So I guess that's the good thing about research, you can travel anywhere in the world. And so now I work with my supervisors Danny Hatters and Andy Hill at the Department of Biochemistry. And my focus has now shifted towards protein aggregation, or what I usually call it is proteins getting really sticky, clumping together and making this massive mess in the cell. And so basically, I'll just briefly tell you what happens is that what I'm interested in is, instead of having a normal protein that has a normal function, which is like a little machine that makes the whole cell run like a well-running factory if everything works well, we get mutations that cause misfolding and the formation of sticky blobs by all these proteins sticking together. So, which you can probably see here, is an aggregate. So, this is very common in a lot of common diseases, such as Alzheimer's disease and Parkinson's, but also Huntington's disease is a protein aggregation disease. And you can clearly see that in a lot of these diseases, there's actually a loss of brain mass because your neurons are dying. So, obviously, that's a very severe disease. So because I'm a very curious person, I don't settle for researching one disease, so I go for multiple. So I'm looking at Huntington's disease, motor neuron disease, and polyalanine diseases. So there are almost 10 polyalanine diseases, but all their names are really complicated, so it'll take me all the 3 minutes just to explain what these diseases are. But basically, usually there's a neuronal phenotype, and as I mentioned, these diseases are very severe. And they're devastating for patients and family because they have neuronal problems. So they don't behave normally as they were anymore. They're hereditary, so you basically load the rest of your family with it as well. And more importantly, there's no cure. So this is why I'm interested in it. And so in my work, I use two main methods. I use this massive centrifuge, which basically spins proteins down really, really fast at 200,000 times gravity. And so this will sediment single proteins, but by varying the speed, we can actually get an idea of how big the aggregates are, because this machine is pretty handy, because it has a laser scanning through the cells as the proteins sediment, which lets me see how fast they go down. And as you can imagine, something that's bigger goes faster. And so I'm also interested in whether, for these different diseases, there are actually different sizes of aggregates, because that might give an indication of what the cell tries to do to make itself better. And my second technique mainly is confocal microscopy, which obviously gives very pretty pictures, but it will also tell me where in the cells these aggregates are and what they actually look like. So it's a bit complicated to explain everything, and I still have a lot to do. There's a lot of mystery there, and I hope to find a lot of answers, because as I said, I want answers. I'm curious. But what I can tell you is, initially, this is a healthy cell, and these are different aggregates, and they look different. They look different, which means that for these different diseases, even though they're classified as protein aggregation diseases, we need to look at them separately. So if we want to gain drug strategies, we can treat it as a general, but we should be looking specifically for these diseases because their mechanisms of action might be really different. That's basically what motivates me to do research.
Thank you, guys. That was absolutely brilliant. I think everyone will agree we've had a real treat, and just how wonderful it is to see the next generation, the early career scientists with that enthusiasm, that excitement. It's really fantastic. I think we can now feel happy that the future of medical research, women in medical research, is in very safe hands. So thank you very much for all your presentations. Okay, so now we're going to move on to the next part of the session, which is the panel discussion. And I invite Pip Patterson to come and chair that discussion. And our panel consists of Elizabeth Blackburn, Ruth Bishop, Ingrid Scheffer, Margaret Scheel, and Judith Whitworth. So back up the front and more questions.
I think the panel is sitting comfortably. Thank you, panel. Well, what a feast we've had today. We've heard from distinguished senior women scientists and a wonderful bunch of future women scientists. Indeed, present future scientists, but they're going on to great things. One of the things that Elizabeth said earlier today, which really struck me and which I'd like to use to begin this panel discussion, is that if we look at the number of students, or look at postdoctoral students, and look at the proportion of women and men, in fact, over half of the current postdoctoral women in medical research are women. And yet, and this fact won't have escaped you, in order to have a senior panel here at the end of the day, we've had to ask our panel members to do three different jobs in some cases. In other words, the numbers are much less in the senior ranks. And I'd like to start by asking the panel about, and we've heard some thoughts they've had certainly on this question, but I'd like to ask them about the institutional factors which they think we can change to change this loss of women scientists from those very promising postdoctoral students through to people in the senior ranks. And so what I'd like to ask each of them is if they've got one piece of advice to give to someone who might be able to bring about some change, who would they give it to and what would it be and why? And I wonder if I could ask you that question in turn. Judith.
I'm not sure I can remember all of the question, but who to? I guess I'd give it to those who ask. I think unsolicited advice is rarely very useful. I actually think the institutions aren't too bad, at least the public sector institutions. I think the real hurdles are societal, and I think we've got the Olympic Games coming up, and we all know that in the Olympic Games things are decided by a fraction of a second. So if things go wrong for you on the day, you're just not feeling quite right or whatever, then you're not going to make it. You're not going to be at the top. And I think for women, the biology of parenthood and family really explains why that pipeline narrows down. We're in a very competitive field, so any little thing that handicaps you is going to lead to people falling out. So the advice I give to people is go for what you want to do, and don't be dissuaded. I mentioned my daughter before, she wanted to produce movies in Hollywood, and I thought it was a pipe dream, but there she is, because she was focused and determined. So my advice to people is to go for what you want to do and put your energy into it. And my stepson gave me who's a very distinguished professional musician, gave me a good bit of advice, which is you only put on your CV the things you get, not the ones you don't. So doesn't matter if you fail at things, just keep hanging in there and focus on the things that you achieve, not the things you don't.
Thanks, Judith.
Just to follow on from what Judith said, I think it's not just biology. I don't think it's just timing. I think it's about choices. And I think women often are trying to do so many things. It's the multitasking a bit of maintaining the family and the life and the career might be just too hard. So we need to change that to make it so it's not too hard. And I don't think it's... I think childcare is very important, but I don't think it's just about having a two-month-old baby and putting them into a childcare facility. As a paediatrician, that doesn't sit well with me. And I think we need to have good ways of handling that. But to answer your question, which I half remember, my thought was that I think the people we need to target are high school students. And we have to show them that science is exciting and there's a career that you can have passion about. To show them that many, many people out in the workforce don't love their work. They go to work, they earn their money and they go home again. And we love our work and we see it's worthwhile with good outcomes that are worthwhile. And we need to show that to the young school students. And their science teachers may not be doing that the way we would be doing it. So somehow that's who I think we should be targeting, the bright adolescent women and men, and showing them that science is a very fulfilling long-term career.
I think my advice would be, and probably to any person who's freshly graduating, don't, if you happen to go into a job that you don't like, for goodness sake, plan to get out of it. Don't stay with it. And when you do find something you really like, just put your heart and soul into it. Keep going. There'll be successes and failures. Hopefully, you will find a mentor who helps you through these. But if you really want to do research, you must keep going, read widely, frame questions, go for them and keep going.
At my institution, we have searches for faculty positions at the assistant professor level right after the postdoctoral level, where, as I said, 50% of the people doing them are women and men. And our applicant pool from that 50-50 ratio is suddenly a very low fraction of women. So I think women are being intimidated. So I would say apply for that position in a really good place. Even if you think you might fail, apply for it. Institutions, as was alluded to, institutions are pretty good about realizing they want men and women faculty. And we, as institutions, are actually wanting this to happen. And we see in our institution the fraction of women applicants is really low. So we're doing something is happening that is intimidating women. So I would say apply for those really good positions, even though you feel afraid that, oh, maybe I won't get it. Don't be afraid of rejection. Just apply for them. I want to see that pool become 50-50 in the applicant pool as well as in the people who are actually finishing their training.
I think one of the things that struck me as everyone was talking is talking about science and the biological sciences and the biomedical sciences, we're actually in a pool where there are many young women and men, and there are 50-50 applying to your... they're not applying, sorry, 50-50 at postdoctoral level. The other issue is that if you go to the physical sciences world where I come from, the women aren't even there. And I think... And then when we've looked, in my former role as head of the ARC, when I looked across it and do a deep dive into success rates, that some of the differentiation is around the quantitative-qualitative divide. So a bit I think it was Ingrid that said, I actually think there's a range of other issues about encouraging women to apply and so on, but one of the key big structural reforms we need to make is mathematics for girls in school. Because I think if I take a cut of the 20% success rate across the ARC schemes, if 60% of the women are in biology and 20% are in chemistry, then already we've done something that discriminates against women overall, or Pip and I have shared the conversation around quantitative psychologists and qualitative psychologists. So for long-term change, to create as many options for women into science careers and more broadly, I think we've got to work at mathematics in high school, and that also means mathematics teachers in high school, and particularly at early role models in primary school.
Thank you. You can hold on to that. I haven't finished. I was really struck that many of your answers actually look to individual factors, things that women scientists can do. I'm really interested in what institutions can do. What can universities do? What can granting agencies do to actually encourage people to step beyond that, whatever it is that's holding them back? And how can they create an environment in which it is possible to have a family and be a good parent at the same time as it is to be a good scientist? I wonder if you've got any thoughts on those things.
I might start, since I've got the microphone and I've got a list. So, can you hear me there? Yeah. So when I joined the ARC, which was 5 years ago, just on 5 years ago, and I looked at this issue of success rates, both success rates for women and application rates. So there's a double whammy. Women actually had a lower success rate and they had a much lower application rate. And the further up you got and the more prestigious the scheme, the fewer women applied. And this is across all areas of research. I was told by a very senior woman not to make this my issue. That was the first thing, which was interesting. You know, don't take this on, Margaret, or I'll define you. So that encouraged me to take it on. And
so much for mentors.
Yeah. And we looked at it and we did a whole program of things. And the first thing we started with was the language. So when you looked at, when I looked through the list of things you couldn't spend ARC grants on, there was one example and it was childcare. Think about the message that sent. So I took childcare out and put mobile phone expenditure and a whole lot of other things that you couldn't spend money on. The concept of how you report your record was called a track record, so that was implies that you get on a track and you never get off. So we got rid of that term, we banished it from the lexicon. And we put more women onto committees and we changed the way people describe their research record and included performance, we included career opportunities up front rather than as an add-on at the end, or by the way, I might have had a couple of babies. We encourage women to put that up front, called it research opportunity performance evidence. And I met someone in the foyer just now who told me that she, after a big career interruption, got an ARC grant, which I was really pleased about. We put more women on committees. It was very clear to all the committees that I was interested in this issue. So when I would go around and visit the committees during their deliberations, I'd walk in and the chair or one of the executives would say, "Oh, we got 25% women, Margaret." You know, so like there was, and they also knew that when they got to the end and had to make decisions, because we could fund down to 40%, but only had money for 20. That in the competition that ensued between disciplines for the last little bit of money, if there were women or early career researchers or someone who had a career gap, they had more chance of convincing the CEO to fund that last proposal. So we actively went looking below the line because it was, you know, it's arbitrary. We're making decisions about funding excellence and we could have funded down to, you know, as I said, 40 or 50%. So the leadership was really important. And after 3 years, we actually for the first time got the same success rate in discovery for men and women. And what's interesting, same woman actually said to me, "Oh, you better not go out and publish that because you mightn't be able to sustain it." But I did. And it's a work in progress. So what will be interesting to me to see is whether that's a sustained change from, you know, within the ARC, or whether it disappears again now that they're going to have a very wonderful male CEO. But I do think the language is really critical, you know, that they call women areas labs with lots of women in them pink ghettos, they call labs with men in them boys' clubs, you know, all that kind of, you know, working through the language to make sure that we're not inadvertently sending the wrong signals. And then there's a whole other issue about trying to encourage women to apply, which I don't think I cracked.
One kind of institution is scientific academies, so the National Academies of Sciences in the US, starting some years ago, started to make a point from the leadership of making sure that women were nominated. And what happened was that, in fact, the demographic of the women who started coming in as they were nominated, they were clearly very good and they got into the academy. So the academy, you know, is a lot of very old people often who are sort of, you know, getting into the national academies, which is a very strong sort of, you know, validation of one's scientific career. And so that's seen as a sort of value, you know, in the scientific research community, you know, in the peer community, that's seen as value. So younger women started getting in, much younger than their male peers, actually, in terms of this positive sort of reinforcement and of the encouragement from the top. And that trend, is, as you're saying, the trend has now continued, sort of it's got its own force. People didn't realize, I'm sorry, people realized that it didn't mean, oh, gosh, you know, we're going to have people in who maybe aren't as good or something like that. It was extremely clear that the women who are in the academies who came in because there was this push from the top to make sure women were nominated, that they're clearly really, really, you know, superb top scientists. So that's one kind of institution, the institution that sort of sets scientific imprimaturs in the scientific research community, that's something that can be done. And it came from the top. It was Bruce Alberts who was very much involved in this as then president of the National Academy of Sciences. So, you know, because I think science is very sort of status-driven in some ways, top kinds of institutions of that kind, it is very important for that kind of leadership too.
I think I've probably been very fortunate in the environment in which I worked. This was at the Royal Children's Hospital. And with the vision and imagination of the Committee of Management, who were mostly women, led by Dame Elizabeth Murdoch, there was money put aside for research projects. There were three groups, a surgical group led by Doug Stevens, a surgeon, a medical group led by Howard Williams, a pediatric clinician, physician, and then my mentor, Charlotte Anderson, who was one of the first people to recognise and report celiac disease in the United Kingdom. She came back and this was her field, it was malabsorption. Those three leaders recruited young people to do research projects, largely, I think, suggested by them, but with encouragement by them as to how to set them up. They had access to money within the hospital, the Research Foundation, and we had small but adequate grants and a lot of support to keep us going. The environment grew and grew and now has become a multi-faceted Murdoch Children's Research Institute. But I think it's still organised in a very similar way. It really is family groups that meet quite regularly and exchange information. When I found the virus, needed a lot of help with biochemistry, immunology, epidemiology, and these groups were all on the campus. I could go to them and engage them and do collaborative projects. And so I think the model that the Children's Hospital began in a very small way in the 1950s has grown, but it remains quite intimate still and quite effective in assisting and helping to finance people at the start of their careers.
I was going to say that I think it's actually got harder in some ways because I think there's less money in the system for extra things. And so if you're a clinician, you used to be able to have more time to go and do some clinical research, and now there's no time. You've got to be clinics or seeing patients or writing letters, and there really is no slack in the system because it's got tighter and tighter. So I actually think it's harder, and I think it's harder for the both basic and clinical scientists to have funding and support. I think the cultures, you know, there's moves to shift things like 7 a.m. meetings, 8 a.m. meetings, 6 p.m. meetings, so that parents can go and do pickups, or, you know, finish clinics in time, to collect your child from childcare. But all that really has to change before people are going to feel comfortable. Otherwise, you get that sense of the 7 a.m. meeting. I didn't make it, and what have I missed? And you weren't part of the team. And I think that's still very, very much alive. The other issue I see is the NHMRC. I'm hoping Judith might be able to help with this a little bit, which I think is that it really has to have systems in place to give people scores somehow that take into account that they've worked 2 days a week for the last 5 years or something, and therefore that will impact on their H indices and their citations and that sort of thing. And then you'll make it more equal with the full-time working male.
Certainly, a track record is supposed to be assessed on the basis of opportunity. So that, as far as I'm aware, is still an instruction, but I think it's not always observed. A couple of comments in relation to what Margaret said about committees, which I think is absolutely right. And I remember a study some years ago, I think from Scandinavia, but that looked at granting panels and their institutions in relation to the institutions that got the successful grants. And what it showed was that even though people declared a conflict of interest and were outside the room, the grants more often went to their institutions than to those that weren't represented on the committee. Now, you can interpret that in a range of ways, nonetheless. One way I interpret is obviously like Margaret does, to think, well, if we want women to do better, let's get more women on the committees. That's not always easy. And I did mention when I talked about mentoring the opportunities that committee work does provide for younger women, and I do think that's an important part of training. The negative is that, and perhaps this was truer some years ago than it is now, but certainly if you're one of the few female professors in a faculty, you can absolutely be ground down by the committee work you have to do, because the institution rightly believes that they've got to have female representation, and you're it. And you don't end up just doing your own faculty, but, you know, the faculty of X won't have any women in it, so you've got to go and do that. And So it can be a bit of a negative. And for that reason, I think an important part of mentoring and leadership training is trying to get younger women and more junior women onto the committees to fill these important roles.
Thank you all.
Could I add one more institutional one, yes, since I failed in your initial question and gave you an individual answer? But something that I could speak about that happened at our institution, I don't know if this happens here, was that there was a survey done in the School of Medicine of faculty, men and women, and they said, was there a pay differential for level, right? So the answer to, so that was done, and the answer, when you matched people, was no. And then they did asked the right question, which was, what was the time to each promotion step? And it was greatly slowed for the women than for the men. But then the positive thing that happened at the institutional leadership level was that each chair of the department was presented with this information and said, and told, well, look, you know, there's this disparity, and in particular cases, here's the disparity. Is this really because this is really justified, or is it just sort of negligence? And it was usually negligence, and then there was actually a correction done. So that meant a continual monitoring and you know, an institutional monitoring of when discrepancies happen, because they can happen, as I said, for negligence, probably for reasons that are socially related to whether women say, well, it's time for my promotion or not. So that was very much an institutional thing in a medical school that I think is a good example of what can be done. Perhaps this is always routinely happening in the University of Melbourne and other places here, but I don't know.
I think Elizabeth demonstrates her optimism.
Well, not optimism, no, my scepticism. It was just a polite way of saying do it, right?
Yes, right. Well, I think there's a few people bursting to ask questions. Let's start here.
I guess one of the issues that really stands out for me if we're talking about institutional change is that the NHMRC, as far as I'm aware, does not allow you to take career development fellowships part-time. And really, I mean, they're the fellowships that you're taking around the time that you're having children, and that wipes people out. If you haven't got funding, then you can't establish an independent research career, and you can't accept that funding if you are not prepared to work full-time. So you're, I think, immediately eliminating those women. And I think women, I mean, there's been studies showing that women are less inclined to go for promotion, even though they're fully qualified, than men. I think they're very influenced by sort of the top. And I think what that message is saying is that it's not worth doing unless you're doing it full time. And I think women take that message on board. And I agree with Elizabeth. I think we need to make the part-time, full-time, equivalently valuable.
Yes, and I must say I've been very encouraged by the discussion we've just had and by the example that Margaret told us about the ARC. You really can change things like that. There's a bunch of more questions. Are we going to do more questions? Yep. Are you're going to ask a question. Yes. Please.
I was really intrigued with something that Elizabeth was saying and the business about women not applying for promotions. And I was thinking about a story somebody told me. It was a colleague, a bloke, who said that he'd been on two committees. One was for the L'Oreal ECR Awards and one was for another award. One was worth $30,000, the L'Oreal was worth $30,000, but you could spend it on anything that was clearly meant for women, and the other one was just an award. And he sat on both committees, and there was, like, out of 100 applications for the $50,000 award, there was something like, you know, maybe 10 were women, whereas for the L'Oreal, they had 360 applications, all of them women. He said the quality of the person who got the $30,000 award was actually higher than the quality of the person who got the $50,000 award, but the women hadn't applied. And so I guess it's that whole thing of how do you actually get people to sort of say, okay, I'm going to apply for this L'Oreal Award, but I'm also going to apply for this other one, because even if I don't get it, it's good for me to keep my CV up, it's good to do stuff. How do we actually get people to do that?
A very good question. And while we're waiting for the next question, I've had some...
Do you want me to answer?
Yes, please.
I keep doing that. Using the L'Oreal example, we made two targeted women fellowships at the Laureate Fellowship level, which is the senior ARC level, one of which is named after Georgina Sweet, who was here with Women's College, and one actually after in the humanities. And we didn't actually get the number of... I was quite disappointed by the number of applications. So I wondered... And we also included with those two fellowships... I mean, we've got absolutely fantastic candidates, but we didn't get the droves that I'd expect, the L'Oreal phenomenon. But we also included provision for them to have some additional money which they could spend in a flexible way to get rid of, around the fact that they were the same women that were on all our committees and doing every other thing. So you need to create incentives, but somehow and if you do it for promotion, so if you actually run, as I did in my former institution, targeted promotion workshops and get the application rates up, you do see the success rate change, but it needs to be somehow you need to get over the achievable issue. You know, so even with the Laureate Fellowships, with the Premier Fellowship, even though we targeted for women, we didn't get the response those numbers for that L'Oreal Fellowship are stunning. So I think we probably need to do more at a different level, you know, so that we get more confidence and people get more confidence. And then in the other academy here, the Technological Sciences and Engineering Academy, which has got a very targeted program for women, we're not seeing the numbers. So there's more than it needs. And I think it's more mentoring. And it's also more about getting them awards and all the other gongs along the way, so that when they do go up for the academy or the Laureate Fellowship, they've got the medal and... You know, so there's a lot of mentoring that has to happen along a whole career span. Sorry.
Thank you. Other question?
I think organisations, institutions need to understand their workforce better than they currently do. And that means understanding, you know, how many women they've got, they usually know that, but where they are and understanding whether that's equally spread. Because as soon as you start to pick down a little bit through the layers, you find that it's not a level playing field, that there are some areas that are actually doing very well in terms of promoting women, but that's not the case in other areas. And I would argue that that's, that exists in medical research as well. In paediatrics, I think there's a lot of women who work in paediatrics. There's probably more in paediatrics than in other areas. So we get a very different impression, but if you go into other settings, it's not the same. I've worked for an organisation who prided themselves on the number of female professors they had. When you took out health sciences faculty, they had almost no female professors in the whole university. So I think wherever you work, you have to understand the workforce and the women in the workforce and where some of the challenges are. And I would say my own institution, it's not a level playing field. It's very uneven.
Anyone want to pick up on that comment? I think I can say, having once done an analysis of the time to promotion, time and rate to promotion within the Faculty of Medicine, Dentistry and Health Sciences at this university, what Elizabeth said about her university is also true here. It does take longer to get promoted. And the promotion rate is less. Interestingly, it's very much at the level A to B or level B to C. In fact, there are no differences at higher levels, so it is about getting through those barriers that have been mentioned on a number of occasions.
Did the university act upon that information? As I described, each chair was approached individually and individually went through all the cases. Did that happen? Did that follow-up happen?
No.
Well...
I can say that it's in my KPIs, so it's an issue that I'm working on now. I'm at this institution very actively, so and you know, with the vice chancellor, I didn't have to raise it with the vice chancellor; he raised it with me. So that's a pretty good sign.
Please.
I think that there are a number of institutions who are really trying to do the right thing, but it's actually quite difficult to get it right. For instance, the Academy of Science for a long time has been aware that, you know, I think when I was elected, I was number 12 out of 400 fellows, and they've really been trying for a long time to get the mix right. I chaired a women's search committee many, many years ago, and that really wasn't very effective in bringing the women up to nomination. We then went to a system in which each committee had to include a woman in its shortlist. And there was outrage because of that. And in fact, most of the outrage came from women because they didn't want to be seen. And I think they were already be seen as a woman candidate. So I'd love to hear the panel's ideas for how you can get the mix right and without promoting people who should not be promoted. How can you recognise the other time commitments of women? I mean, myself, I would love to see that it's not just women, but we should also be assessing whether candidates have spent a lot of extra time being a sculptor or teaching, for instance, and they don't do that either.
Thank you. Panel.
I'm looking for someone on the right to pass the microphone. I mean, it's really a vexed question about... whether you have quotas and what it means in terms of equity and getting the best people. I don't have a very firm view. I guess, in general, I feel that probably there are some advantages in quotas for a time to try and get things right and then move on. But I think it is a difficult question. We could debate it for a very long time as to whether or not it's the way to go. Some organisations have gone that route. Others haven't. One of the elephants in the room, of course, is this the bias of which you're unaware. Mm. Yeah. And this, I think, all of us have sat round promotion committees and been very, very aware of that. And if as a woman on a committee, one does say, oh, but this woman's done really good things and also she's got six kids and looks after her mother-in-law, then the conversation lags a bit and then it moves on to another topic, in my experience.
I think something that hasn't been addressed is that women have a different phenotype. I sort of talked about it in terms of science, but I think it's very relevant to these award applications. And one of the things is that maybe the Gen Y thing will change this. I think it has already. You can see it a little bit. But just the way about promoting yourself and do you step forward? Are you the first one or the last one to pick up this microphone? I think that women respond very differently to these situations. And I think the L'Oréal fellowships are great because you've got to be a woman, so go for it. And you've got to... It's carrying quite a bit of prestige now. I've just been on the jury, so I had the experience of seeing how high the level of the candidates was. It was very high indeed. But I think with these other fellowships, oh, I'm not good enough. And I think that's what lots of women do. And particularly women who work with outstanding men, as I do, and then you live in their shadow and it takes a long time to come out. When I got my fellowship, the media guy said, oh, we're so pleased when it goes to a complete unknown. I think there are big issues for women in science, and the more that we can help support and mentor, the better.
Well, I think to Jenny's point about having positive, sort of movement to having people nominate women for, as you said, the National Academy is one thing that, the lesson learned in the US National Academies was that, it wasn't as if a whole lot of sort of no good duds got into the academy. They were really good, the women who got in, and I think people realised, oh yes, this didn't tear down the fabric of the august academy. Gosh, they're really okay. And I think that kind of push may be very helpful to just do it. Frankly, I noticed that women who are doing science and so on, they're pretty good. You probably could pretty much bet that they're the ones you want to have voted into the academy anyway. So I'm somewhat in favour of having an organised push, even though, as you said, women might resist this sort of thinking, oh, they're just going to be admitting us and therefore they're not really thinking we're as good as they are, but they're just doing it because somebody is making us do it. I think that's the unspoken fear that is there, that, oh yes, it's just because, this person is getting a prize or is getting admitted to some august body or getting a job because she's a woman, right? And I think people realise that just doesn't sort of hold much water, but I think the fear is still somewhat there. So I would say, yes, push these quotas for a while. You don't have to call them quotas, but just sort of push this sort of emphasis. Make sure that you're really going out and we end search committees, as I was talking about, for positions for assistant professorships. We actively, go out and seek out women applicants. So we're doing an informal part of action of affirmative action, which, as I recall, is still illegal at the University of California. You're not supposed to do it, so we just do it by telephone calls, So institutionally speaking, one can certainly make things happen just when there's a will to make things happen.
I'll just make one more comment there, the people that resisted my changes at the ARC were older male applicants. Who told me I was abandoning the ARC's commitment to excellence. And my response was that the conception of excellence was also narrow, and so you have to broaden your conception of excellence. It's not actually, and really I used to say to the Laureate Committee, this isn't actually about a gong at the end of somebody's career. This is actually investment in further 5 years of someone's future. And you want to invest in the best future. And so if you start changing that and around and thinking about what actually does excellence mean, and does it mean just this traditional form of excellence that's been a particular paradigm in science or whatever form of research you're talking about, you can start to broaden that debate.
Well, what a wonderful way to finish on that way of really dealing with some of the unconscious biases that exist. But I think this very positive but also a little bit sober discussion about how to promote women in science, I think just illustrates, well, first of all, what a great future there is, but also what an outstanding job our panel has done to become such great scientists in a world like that. So would you please join me in thanking them for their contribution today. And I'll hand over to Julie Bynes.
Thank you very much. My name is Julie Bynes from the Department of Paediatrics, the University of Melbourne. And on behalf of the organising committee of this event today and the Faculty of Medicine, Dentistry and Health Sciences, I'd like to thank all the speakers and all the chairs for making this such a successful event today. We've been really treated with wonderful stories of achievement and wonderful insights and inspiration, I think, to take home with us tonight. I would like to especially thank Professor Elizabeth Blackburn for coming and joining with us today. She has a great story and terrific experience and wisdom for which she shared with us. For all the presenters today, the keynote presenters, we have a small token of our appreciation for contributing to the event, and for also for the speakers after lunch, we have a little token also which will perhaps after the session, if you don't mind popping up, and we're very appreciative also for your contribution. This event has been part of the University of Melbourne Medical School's 150th birthday celebration, and it's a wonderful year of celebration for the university and the School of Medicine. I think particularly it's been really terrific today to have support from the university as a whole. And we're very grateful for Professor Patterson for coming today and chairing our session, Professor Margaret Scheel for also coming, and our Chancellor, Miss Elizabeth Alexander. It's great to see such great support from the top of the university, so thank you and we greatly appreciate it. We're also very grateful for the Department of Biochemistry, Molecular Biology, the School of Chemistry and the Faculty of Medicine, Dentistry and Health Science for providing the funding that's enabled Professor Elizabeth Blackburn to participate in the colloquium. Professor Blackburn has been visiting Australia as part of the Hooked on Sciences School program supported by the Australian Academy of Science, Atlantic Philanthropies, the Victorian State Government and VESCI, and we really appreciate and acknowledge their support. Finally, I would like to also acknowledge the efforts of the working group that has put together this event, chaired very ably by Leanne Tilley today, and I really appreciate her hard work. Also by co-members Jane Gunn, Elizabeth Hartland, and Ingrid Sheffer. This group has been ably supported by Marion Ezzers, Liz Bretnell, and Jan Powell, and I really appreciate their efforts to making this day come together. Thank you also for your attendance and the lively discussion. We'd like to, on the behalf of the Faculty of Medicine, Dentistry and Health Sciences, invite you to drinks in the foyer after this session and to continue ongoing discussion. So thank you very much to all.